that in this session, what we're doing is a kind of an initial overview of space, time, and knowledge. So the way the session is set up is we're spending 2 weeks on space, and then 2 weeks on time, and then 2 weeks on knowledge. So we're this is our introduction to space. And I mentioned that because, you know, you shouldn't think that we're going to get everything cleared up and resolved right now. We're introducing some ideas. Now, these are very fundamental ideas. It's not as though we're starting with the simple stuff. You know, we're jumping right in. But there will be many, many opportunities to revisit these themes, to come back to them. And yeah, Michael says, "Are we there yet?" Right, we're not here, we're not there. That's what TSK tells us, I guess. Or we are both here and there, or something. Anyway, the thing about the TSK vision, one of the really important things to keep in mind, and that's why I was hesitant about the word substance when I said the substance of the vision, is that there isn't any one approach in the vision. The whole idea of vision, and actually we'll be talking about this quite a bit when we talk about different ways of experiencing or understanding space. That's one of the things we're really going to look at today. There's so many different ways, and there isn't one of them that say, okay, now when you do TSK, you have to understand space like this. There isn't any particular understanding. There isn't any particular definition. Space has to do with freedom, and we'll talk about that more today. And that means also freedom from any particular theory or any particular understanding. The vision, there's something interesting in the word vision. I think it's a really nice word in English. Because it's not a question of seeing a particular thing. That's not what vision is about. A vision has to do with a way of seeing. And then when you have that way of seeing, new things, you know, you can see new things. And that's one way of thinking about how TSK works. Okay, so having said that, it may help understand, it may help us kind of go into really the first thing I wanted to talk about, which is this interesting statement at the bottom of page 10, where Rinpoche writes, "We are not concerned with conventional truths," right? He says, this new consideration of space is not concerned with conventional truths. And I'm sure that a lot of thought went into the word consideration, because it's not a new understanding, it's not a new theory, it's not a new, explanation. It's not even a new way of seeing space. The word consideration, I think, is meant to be as open as possible. But in any event, the idea here is that we're not trying to say this is the real way that space is. You know, we're not trying to say our conventional understanding is wrong, and here's another understanding that's right. You could say that up to a point. It'd be better to say our conventional understanding limits us too much. That seems fair. And we want to open up those limits. But opening up those limits doesn't mean putting in place some other version. You know, later on in the reading we had for today, Rinpoche makes a point which is very nice in English. I'm not so sure it works in other languages. He says, space is what makes room for appearance. But what we do is we make a room out of space. We make it into something that has its own borders and limits. And so we don't want to make a bigger room. You know, there are reasons for doing that. Or we don't want to, if you imagine that we're in a house, so here's one room, and we've lived our whole life in this room, and then we find our way outside, and we walk down the hall, and there's another room. Well, that might be very interesting, And you might even say, I'm probably taking this image too far, but let's say in the room you were in before, you could look out the window and there was a certain view. And now you walk into another room and you look out the window and the view is very different, even though perhaps you're seeing the same things. Okay, that's helpful. And we'll try to get a little better sense today of why that's helpful. But it's not fundamentally what the vision is about. And that's why Rinpoche can say we're not concerned with conventional truths. If you're on the conventional level, then you're going to say, and what that means basically is if there's a certain space in operation or if there's a certain focal setting in operation, and we'll talk about focal setting in a bit, then you're going to be able to say this is true and this is false. That's what it means to be occupying a particular space. There are certain things that are so and other things that are not so. But if you're challenging the whole idea that space is a particular room, you know, is a particular set of possibilities, then the fact that within conventional space something is true or not true doesn't matter. And that's why you can say that space isn't concerned with truth on the conventional level. And of course, this comes up with respect to that sentence that ended the last reading about space projecting space into space. Rinpoche says, well, that doesn't make sense on the conventional level. We know that it doesn't, but we don't care. We're suggesting something different. And one of the ways that he talks about that is in terms of symbols, right? Whatever is true at a particular level can be seen as a symbol of, let's say, a higher level. We'll come back to that. So the way Rinpoche talks about that actually is on page 11. Let's go at the very top of page 11. So he's talking about he starts off at the bottom of page 10 saying we have a concept of what space is, and that's really important. I'll say more about that in a moment. We have a concept of what space is, but it's not a question of putting another concept into place. And he says, instead of remaining bound to the conventional level of purposes, things, and space, so on the conventional level we have purposes, we have things, and we have space, a certain concept of what space is. Right? Instead of that, we can take advantage of the fact that such ordinary items remain potent symbols of a higher and more primary level. And this is what we've been talking about. We talked about it at the end of the last session as in terms of a in terms of second level space, you know, when we looked at that. He says, whatever shows up on the ordinary level can also be understood as a potent symbol, a powerful symbol of a higher and more primary level. There is a sense in which, as a perception, or better still, as a vision, ordinary space may be related to the primary ground of all existence. So what are we interested in connecting with or understanding or opening our vision to? Well, it's this sense of a primary ground of all existence. In the end, even that may be a little bit too limiting, but it doesn't sound so limiting right now. We'll stay with that. So it's not a question of a wider space, a broader space, a different space. It's a question of finding a way to take ordinary space as a symbol of this primary ground of all existence. So, in a way, he's laying out what's going to happen in the TSK vision, certainly in this first book. In that next paragraph, he says, contemplating space as a result of pushing our examination of existence as far as we can actually guides our awareness into new types of spaces. So that's a step we take along the way until we can reach a kind of space that is, in more than a symbolic way, the ground of everything. And we want to, again, he's going to this primary ground, the ground of everything. That's the possibility that he's suggesting. So the idea is that you know, you can, one of the ways to proceed is by adopting new focal settings or discovering new focal settings. So the guiding image there, we didn't talk about that last week, so let me just say a little bit about it. The guiding image is like in a microscope or looking through the lens of a camera. If you adjust the focal setting, different things come into focus. And the world that you see is very different. So you might think about, for instance, if you've had this experience, when you're an adult going back and visiting the place where you grew up, you see it with a very different focal setting, and things look really, really different, right? The most obvious thing is everything looks much smaller, but there's also many things that you may not see. And you know, we've all had experiences like that, so I'm not going to dwell on it. So shifting focal settings is an important step that we can take, and learning how to do that is an important step. And therapy really works like that a lot. You know, people have trouble, they have problems because they see things a certain way, and if they can see them differently, if they can shift their focal setting, then those problems shift also. And that in itself is really important, and it's one of the things that can happen in the TSK vision. But it's not the fundamental move that we'd like to be able to make. Rinpoche goes into that at the bottom of page 12 and the top of page 13. He's presented this vision that space is like, our ordinary space is like, it has a limiting function, just like a little, a local governing official, he says, who kind of runs things his own way. And he says, there are infinitely many different spaces deriving from different focal or epistemic settings. So epistemology, in case that word is new to some of you, has to do with a theory of knowledge, the way we know things. So a different epistemic setting would mean knowing things in a different way. Because, anyway, he says, each space has its own subtly limiting dynamics. We could open our focal setting to expose each one and venture indefinitely through them. However, the point is not to discover alternative spaces, each with its own view. So, I don't know, perhaps it's fair to compare that to certain kinds of drug experiences is what I was thinking of. You know, when people, it's like the focal setting shift, you know, something in your brain starts to gets rewired because of the drug, and you see things differently. Well, okay, good to know. You know, I think people sometimes find that to be very liberating because they realize there's more than one focal setting. That's tremendously important. But, you know, just exploring different possibilities is not so great. It's like reading a novel. People read novels to enter, you know, a different world, you could say, and that's something like different focal settings. But just, you know, reading one novel after another or seeing one movie after another, it's sort of entertaining while it's going on, but it's not so helpful. So here at this point on page 13, Rinpoche introduces a different possibility. He says a properly guided journey through certain of these spaces, through these different spaces that open when we shift or open our focal setting. If we can take a journey that's guided, not just kind of here and there and everywhere, can result in the perception that they can be meaningfully ordered There are spaces which are higher and bigger as opposed to lower and smaller. And if you ask what that means, it seems to mean that if you go back to the notion that there's a primordial foundation, the primary ground, that there's a primary ground of existence and we'd like to be able to connect with that. Well, some spaces, because they're more open or higher or bigger, lead more in that direction. And one way of thinking about that that we'll look at later is that they may offer more freedom, more openness. They may be more accommodating. Well, some spaces are more accommodating than others. I think that's basically what he's saying here. So, yes. Well, I think the right word is freedom. If we come to a place that is in a sense, and this is not quite accurate, but is the source of all possible focal settings, the source of all possible spaces, then first of all, we are free to enter any other space. It seems as though, you know, our freedom is radically increased in that way. But there's also something more fundamental, and this has to do with, you know, primary ground here. We can link up to what Rinpoche says about great space, which I think he introduces right below this, right below the section we were just looking at. The sense of great space is, or the significance of great space, or the primary ground, is that we are operating on a different level in which we're not just always in a particular framework, in a particular room. You know, we're at the level where room itself is operating, and then a different kind of knowledge operates. And so that's my second answer, I suppose, is that if we're in contact with that, then the kind of knowledge available to us is also fundamentally different. Freedom, knowledge, he also mentions words, he mentions the word creativity, certainly, greater creativity. But I would say freedom, knowledge, and so, you know, naturally, I have to think of that in terms of time and space and knowledge. So we'd say in terms of space, there's greater freedom and openness. In terms of knowledge, there's a different kind of knowing that's available. We can't say too much about that yet. And in terms of time, which we haven't really focused on, but what we could say in a very preliminary way, is that you're at the level where time's dynamic is available, not just what time presents, but time's dynamic. So, sure, it's a good question. Always good to ask. You know, so why should we be doing this? What's the point? Okay. The ordinary sense of space that we have, or the ordinary space that we inhabit, let's say, is in some ways we don't inhabit it at all. So I have to say that kind of, I have to be careful how I say that. So back on page 10, I think it was, Rinpoche said, you know, we live in a world in which there are things and I don't remember exactly events and space. And so we live in a particular realm, and in that sense, you could say a particular space, you know, that grows out of a particular focal setting. And in that focal setting, we have a certain understanding of what space is. But the understanding we have of what space is that it's nothing at all. We've talked about that before. It's a kind of a conceptual understanding. It's actually very similar to the understanding of time, now that we've brought in time a little bit, you know. We think of time in terms of past, present, and future, but that's not the dynamic. It's not, you know, if somebody asks you what time is, you're likely to reply in terms of past, present, future, but you haven't really connected with the dynamic of time. And the same thing is true of space. You know, if somebody asks you what space is, and you said, well, space is what allows things to show up at all, they appear in space, that doesn't necessarily tell us anything about what space is. Space in the realm that we inhabit is just kind of a conceptual structure. We're not in contact with it in any way. So let's take a look at a comment by Remco here. He says, great space, primary level, ground of being. These terms sound very much like the terms that are used, for example, in the Kindly Bent to Ease Us books. Now, he's referring to a set of books written by, or it's a translation of some texts written by a Nyingma Lama in the 14th century, and they're translated under the title Kindly Bent to Ease Us, especially the Wonderment book. Do you think it's helpful to understand these topics by studying the Wonderment book? Well, I'm sure it's helpful. That doesn't mean I recommend it, though, because if you go and if you look there, then you'll be entering a whole different, not just conceptual space, but experiential space, and a lot of things will come up that don't really go in the direction of time, space, and knowledge. But I think it's certainly true that the vision that guides TSK is not in any way, well, I was going to say it's not in conflict with the vision that you find in Buddhism, but it's probably more to say that it's better, more realistic to say that it parallels in some way the vision that you find in a book like the Wonderment book. It's volume 3 of Kindly Bent to Ease Us. And Caroline asks a similar question. I was going to ask if primary ground is a translation of kunji. See, that's a perfect example of why I don't exactly recommend doing it, although if you find it helpful to do so, if you find it illuminating, then do it. But the reason I don't recommend it is because the moment you say, well, primary ground, isn't that kunji? You would have to understand that kunji, the exact meaning of kunji, is debated endlessly in the Tibetan tradition. There are many different positions. And so now suddenly you find yourself with a whole set of conceptual concerns. And in a way, you could say the TSK vision is introduced so that we don't have to concern ourselves with that. Because if you really wanted to understand what kunji is, you should learn Tibetan and you should spend years, studying in depth the discussions, and of course, if it branch out into the whole of Buddhism, you could say. It seems like we don't want to go too far in that direction. But if you find it helpful to dip in, I'm not saying don't do it. I'm sure some people would find it helpful. What I have always said to people about the relationship between some Buddhist teachings, like what Longchenpa presents, and there's other things you could point to. The relationship between those teachings and TSK is that I find that the TSK vision, insofar as I understand anything about those Buddhist topics, I've learned about them through studying TSK, not so much the other direction, not using the Buddhist teachings to illuminate TSK. But people will find their own way. Michael also responds to that. On a different point, I'll go ahead and read his comment. He says, Caroline, during this call, the windows behind you have gone from early dusk to nightfall. Caroline is on video, and so we get a chance to see her surroundings, as we do with Hayward. Time passing, Earth turning her face toward a new light, a new night, a new space. Well, let's see. So our usual connection with space is really hardly a connection at all. It's just kind of conceptual. We can't take hold of space. But there's something very important about the concept of space, because it's not just a concept. And that goes back to the idea or that Rinpoche has introduced, that lower level presentations, and he mentions, let me go back to page 10, because it's actually, the good said. He says, at the conventional level, there are purposes, there are things, and there's space. And he says that any one of those can act as a symbol that points toward a more fundamental or a more open space, and ultimately points toward the primary ground or toward great space. And by the way, I don't mean to say that the primary ground is another term for great space. They're related. Let's just leave it like that. I don't think there are actually many places in the TSK books where Rinpoche talks about primary ground. He brings it up here. But if I'm wrong, if people want to look it up and maybe bring it to the attention of the group, then please do. He says purposes, things, and space can all be symbols that point us towards something that's higher or more open. And that power is important. And what Rinpoche says about, not exactly about that, but I think about the power of space, is right in the middle of page 12, at the end of the first full paragraph. He's comparing space, lower space, to some of the concepts of space in physics, which we don't need to get into at all. But again, some people might find that a helpful way in. He says, he says this lower or local space, that is the space that we inhabit, right, is responsible for the character of all events and appearances perceived in space. So space has this very, in that sense, it has tremendous power. And the nature of that power is based on the idea, I think, that space is what allows, space is what makes room or accommodates. Those are all different ways of talking about the same thing. And one of the things that's clear, and if we look at that quote, is that it's not physical space. And I mentioned that in the orientation, I mentioned that Rinpoche kind of takes that for granted in the first few pages, the ones we read for last week. We'll come back to it. We'll certainly look quite a bit at the mental realm and the sense in which we can speak of that as being, let's say, spacious. I think it's pretty clear, actually. It's put well in the reading that we had last week from When It Rains. On page 34, it says, if we say that the space we perceive or encounter or interact with is a function of our interest or concerns, then there's no reason to limit space to the physical domain. And, of course, that just raises the question, well, why would you want to say that? Why would you want to say that space is a function of our interests or concerns? Let's look at that for a moment, but here's a comment by Michael, or a question. Does pointing toward great space, require a movement through a local space in which we remain embodied and interested in pointing? I think the answer to that is yes, in the sense that we always inhabit a space, right? And maybe in some spaces, the way in which we can connect with great space is through a movement in which we remain embodied and we're pointing toward. There might be other spaces in which that's not the right way to think about it, or that's not an accurate description, let's say. So the answer is kind of yes and no. If we think in terms of our ordinary conventional space, it seems like you'd want to say this and say what you said. And perhaps it would be true more generally, but also perhaps not in every possible case. So I wanted to say a couple of things more about this notion that space is not just physical. And that is what Rinpoche says in the quote we looked at on page 12. He says, this lower space is responsible for the character of all events and appearances perceived in space. So certainly events and appearances are going to include things like thoughts and memories and plans and concerns and wishes and emotions and all of that. And he's saying that lower space is really responsible for all of that. So it's not just physical. Now, in the optional reading for this week, there was a simple example. It was something that I wrote, and there was a simple example that I gave, which I think helps make this point very clearly. What I said was that if you're walking down the street and you have a sense of being really embodied and you're appreciating what you see around you, whatever that happens to be, then you're inhabiting a particular space, right? And that's your focal setting. But if you start thinking about where you're going, which is maybe the store, and you're going to buy some food, and then you're going to come home and cook a meal, and you start thinking about what you'll buy and what the meal is going to be like and so on, now you're inhabiting a completely different space. And it's a mental space. Whether it's affected by your embodiment, you know, that's a question. It's an interesting question. But it's, you know, I don't have an answer to it, so it's worth looking at. But the real point is that it's a different space. So space is not just physical. I just want to make that point now. We'll come back to it later on in the program. But I wanted to try to give you a sense of what that is about. Now, I actually wanted to take that as a practice, and it's the practice that that we did as a walkabout practice, as I'm calling them. Of course, you can also do it sitting down. but it's a walkabout practice. The question that I asked, the practice that I gave was asking yourself whether you can enter the space of a thought. I may not have put it quite that way, but I did roughly say that. So that presupposes another question, which is, what is the space of a thought like? And it varies. So it depends partly on what you mean by thought, so you could get complicated about it. But if you have a thought that is that involves a visual image, so if you're thinking about being in the store later and buying food, let's say, then entering the space of that thought might be entering the space of the store that you're imagining. But it might not be. It might be something different. I'm going to give you a quick example, and then I really want to do this practice, ask us to do it right now as a practice. Several years ago, I was at a conference that was organized. It was a CCI conference. Somebody was presenting an approach in which you really had a chance to look at what was going on in your mind from moment to moment. And then later, people were asking questions about it. And so I remember I was specifically saying, well, I was thinking about this person across the room from me. And someone asked the question, where was that thought located? And when they asked the question, I realized my best sense was that it was located where the person was. It wasn't located in my head, certainly, but it was located where the person was. So you know, the whole notion of what counts as the space of a thought is open to question. And I remember we had there was someone at that conference who's a well-known psychologist who has written about these kinds of things. And when I said that, he said, well, that's not possible. That can't be. But that was my experience. And on this kind of thing, I think experience is the place to start. So that's the practice I'd like us to do for a couple of minutes and then comment on, and then I'll take a couple of minutes just to say a little more about great space. but let's first do this practice. So the practice here is just let the mind go, and when a thought comes up, and it may be a verbal thought, I didn't say anything about verbal thoughts. It may be a visual thought, it may be some other kind of thought. See if you can enter the space of that thought. And what does that mean? The first question is what does it even mean to enter the space of a thought? So let's look at that. Okay? A couple of minutes. Okay, so I'm going to give people a chance to comment on that. Now, I know this is also the practice you did during the week, so if you'd like to say something about what you noticed during the week, that's, of course, fine. I will, since it usually takes people a little while to write a comment, I'm going to say something, which is one of the things I noticed that about entering the space of a thought is that it brings with it its own time, its own temporality. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. So it doesn't. So in that more open space or condition, there isn't content as such. Is that what you're saying, or is it a different content? Okay. Okay. Good. So Caroline writes here, I noticed that some thoughts involve being in two places at once. This raised a new question. How many spaces, times can I inhabit simultaneously? Well, that's always an interesting question, isn't it? There's a question you can ask that's related to that, which is, you know, how many contents can you have in mind simultaneously? There's some exercises in the TSK books that go in that direction. It's an interesting question. And Caroline also says, it's a bit like doing giant body exploration with thoughts instead of body. Yes, exactly. It is, absolutely. But it's very different, exactly, because we're not using the body, right? David writes, I was thinking of some things I must do in the next few days. The string of connective thoughts sequencing across my mind's eye. So I'm assuming that those, I'm not sure, but I'm assuming from that description that the thoughts were, had kind of a visual quality to it. You were imagining doing this and then imagining doing that. There was space that needed to be filled in between sequenced activities. There was the space I noticed the entire sequencing was passing before me. There was an emotional charge attached in these activities, some dread perhaps, okay, the space of that dread. You know, you could certainly talk about the space of an emotion. And then he says, looking forward to finishing, there was that space of completion. So that's interesting because that's sort of a theoretical space, right? There was a space in which there was a sense of completion, but it hasn't happened yet. But it's very interesting. So many possibilities, right? So Bruce says, at first I located the thought and imagined merging into it. But then I realized that the location of the thought was a small area in my head associated with subtle subvocal muscular movements, and that this wasn't the thought at all. Okay. Suddenly it seemed boundless, and I was already in it. Then this also seemed a little misleading, but it did open me to the next moment, movement, in which I just allowed myself to move into intimate resonance with the subtle feelings and senses of the thought. Okay, that's a very nice description, and it shows the richness of doing something like this. I'm always very impressed when we do these little 2-minute exercises, and then people have very interesting experiences. I think that's a great way to do TSK, even though taking the time to go into a practice taking more time, let's say, which is what Rinpoche often recommends, that has its own power and strength. Hayward says, I find the language, and then he quotes, appearance as expressions of time and space, more immediate and evocative than symbols of time and space. Okay. Rinpoche, don't think, again, this is the kind of thing that it's worth looking at, and you can use the CD for this by doing searches on particular terms. How often does he use the word symbol in the books? That's an interesting question. If someone would like to do that research, it's easy to do with the CD, and post something online about that or on the website. My own sense is that he doesn't use the word symbol as much in the later books, and you could say that he's kind of experimenting in this first book. On the other hand, you can say, the first book is a really wonderful, complete expression in itself, so the fact that he doesn't use it later doesn't really matter. Bruce made a correction, but I'm not going to go back and correct it because we're out of time. We have a couple more comments. Michael says, different kinds of spaces accompany different thoughts. I asked myself why I write in the chat area. Okay. Instead of speaking up, I assume. One answer was that I enjoy it. This felt open. Another answer was that I learned best by doing. This felt like a maxim filed away in the filing cabinet of old received knowledge, and this felt more closed. Okay, so you gave an explanation, and you connected to your own experience. Those are two different spaces as well. And then Karin writes, the content is getting less important. So when you do this, the content gets less important. What is the difference between worlded space and content and stories? So it would help for me if I knew where the context was for worlded space. But since we're basically out of time, I'll just go ahead and plunge right into the space of that question. Space gives a world. And that world isn't exactly, content, the content that you find and the stories that you inhabit are a part of that world. Or you could say the world is given by the stories. That you have to play with that a little bit. So that's the best I can do right now. Leave it open. We are out of time. Let me see if there's something I think it's really, really important to say about great space. I think we've already, you know, touched on that. I suppose the main thing to say is that the way Rinpoche presents great space here is that if we move through spaces, different focal settings, and we see that some spaces are more open and allow for more freedom, great space is the highest expression of that freedom. And he uses the term highest expression, I believe. So it's not as though, you arrive at some special space in the end that's called great space. Of course, I think we've already seen enough to see that that's not so. It's more this possibility for freedom. So great space really, in a sense, has nothing to do with our ordinary understanding of space. But at the same time, great space is available in every space, in all spaces. And lower space is a symbol of that availability and that freedom. I'm not going to try to say any more about that. I will go ahead and finish up with the comment that Brigitte makes on the exercise. I was looking at a tiny Tara statue, mainly looking, no content, still a thought quality. The space seemed huge. I was absorbed in it. When I moved to some other things on the shelf, a photograph of some owls, the space around the owls, or the space around the seeing of the owls, those were possibilities, seemed smaller. Okay, the one thing I'll point to there that's interesting is that even when you're looking, just looking, no content, there's still a sense in which it's a thought quality. You know, there's a space of looking. And in some ways, there's everything that's involved in making that looking, that seeing possible. There's the one who's looking. There's what's being looked at. You could call that a thought quality. You could call it a story quality. You could call it a worlded space in that sense. These are all things we're exploring. So those are our explorations for now. You might want to review the last couple of weeks. Because we're going to move on now to time. So you might want to kind of go back through your impressions as you've worked with space in this initial pass through and write up any insights or anything you think will help you, you know, the next time you come and look at what you've written. If you think it'll be helpful, by all means, write it down. I'm going to, in the orientation, I suppose, or perhaps in a separate post, I'm going to say something about the mentoring process and the assignments and so on. We've pretty much got that set up now with the teachers, so I'll be writing about that in the next couple of days. Okay, sorry for running a little over. Thank you very much, and see you next week.